This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Hank Jones, the musician Whitney Balliet said was widely regarded as the dean of jazz pianists, died yesterday at the age of 91. Jones and his two brothers became one of the most remarkable families in jazz history. Elvin Jones played with John Coltrane and became one of the most influential jazz drummers. Thad Jones played trumpet and co-led one of the most important big bands in the post-big band era. Hank Jones was the oldest of the brothers, and he lived longer than they did. He was the first to leave home. He toured with Jazz at the Philharmonic, recorded with Charlie Parker, accompanied Ella Fitzgerald, and worked for many years as a house pianist at CBS. He recorded many albums as a sideman and a leader. We're going to listen back to an interview I recorded with Hank Jones in 2005. Let's start with his 1987 recording of "Swonderful," featuring Eddie Gomez on bass and Jimmy Cobb on drums. Jones, welcome to Fresh Air. We're so glad to have you on the show.
Well, thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure being here.
Let me start with what I know is a very obvious question, and it's probably the question you've been most asked about your career, which is, what do you think is the explanation for the fact that you and your late brothers Elvin and Thad Jones became such great musicians? I mean, was there something in your water? Was there something in your house, in your family? What do you think explains it?
Well, the only thing in the water were parasites. But I think the fact that both my mother and my father were musical had a lot to do with it, you know. And we come from a very religious background. Both my mother and my father were very religious. My father was a devout Christian all of his life. And he taught us the things, the moral values, I think, is something that Some parents don't teach their children. We learn more. I learned that early on. And my father, for instance, wouldn't even allow a pack of cards to be in the house. He was against gambling, drinking, smoking, you name it. He was a very, very devout Christian. And I think that had something to do with it. My father's main thing was that he didn't object to music per se, but he thought that no jazz should ever be played in the church. And he thought that if you had any kind of musical talent, it should be then exhibited in the church in the form of accompanying choirs or playing church music and so forth. But never any jazz in the church, and never played on Sunday, by the way.
Did you play in the church?
Yes, I played. I accompanied the church, the junior choir and the senior choir, both on organ and piano. And later, many years later, I actually played a jazz concert at a church in Tenafly, New Jersey. And the audience loved it. In fact, they invited us to do it over again. But I felt somewhat guilty, and I just didn't want to do it again. I thought that my father might not have approved.
What are some of the things you think you learned about the piano and about harmony and rhythm from playing in the church accompanying the choirs?
Well, all of the church hymns that were played and sung, some of which were written by Martin Luther, were all harmonically correct. And I think that some of that carried over into my musical thinking, the phrases and not the melodies particularly, but the way the hymns were phrased and the harmony that was used, I'm sure, carried over into my musical thinking.
How old were you when you went to New York to play in 43 or 44?
I was 20, 21 at the time.
And so you were performing, I think, on 52nd Street or near 52nd Street, which was really quite a music scene in that period. Who were some of the other musicians who were playing near where you were playing?
Well, right across the street was a club called the Three Deuces. I was working with Hot Lips Page, Oran Hot Lips Page, at a place called the Onyx Club. And right across the street on 52nd Street was a club called the Three Deuces. Well, over there you had Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Max Roach, Bud Powell, sometimes Al Haig, sometimes Stan Levy on drums. And they were all about the same age. Dizzy was a little older. Dizzy Gillespie, that is, had a big band about that time, and the big band had broken up into a small group, and the small group was playing at the Three Deuces. They were playing this new style of music called bebop, a term that I have never been really happy with, but it described the music pretty much, but not accurately. Anyway, this is the kind of the style of music these people were playing. I was attracted by it. I thought it was an advance over what I'd been hearing previously to that time. So I unconsciously, perhaps, or maybe consciously, began to adapt some of this style into my own style of playing, which was basically a two-handed style, perhaps in the style of Teddy Wilson, Fats Waller at the time.
Did you go through a period of frustration in which you were trying to adapt your style to this new bebop sound? And I mean, was there a period when you couldn't quite figure out how to get it?
It meant that I had to listen to these things repeatedly over time, perhaps night after night, as long as I could, because, you see, between the sets that I played at the Onyx Club and the sets that the other club was playing across the street, there was maybe 20 minutes between. So I had to go over and listen in 20 minutes as hard as I could for several times during the night. And that way, at the end of the night, I'd have a pretty good idea of what was going on. I still couldn't play it because I was still absorbing this style in my mind, you know. It took quite a while. It didn't happen overnight, and I haven't mastered it yet.
Let's hear a recording that you made with Charlie Parker, and this is from 1952. We'll hear the song as you, and it features you, Parker, and Max Roach on drums. We heard my guest, Hank Jones, at the piano with Charlie Parker. So, Hank Jones, when you were starting to record and when you moved to New York, how old were your brothers, Elvin and Thad, and at what stage in their musical development were they?
Well, Elvin and Thad were both up in Detroit at the time I came to New York, and they were working at a club called the Bluebird. I think it was on Grand River Avenue. And they were working with musicians, the likes of J.J. Johnson, Sonny Stitt, even at times Charlie Parker, and people like that, who came through Detroit to play. And Bluebird was the club to play at because it was probably the best-known jazz club in Detroit at the time. And they were the house band there. So they had to play with all these people that came through to play at the club. So by the time they got to New York, they were already fairly familiar with the New York jazz scene, having heard these people in Detroit, you see. So,
as the older brother, what kind of advice or help did you try to give them when they were young?
Well, I guess I told them the same things that my father tried to tell me, you know, stay clear of all of these vicious habits that people get into that their health, that deprive you of your health, eventually probably your life as well. And this is what happened to some of the younger musicians who came to New York and fell into that kind of thing. Probably they weren't able to see if they had been able to resist that first attempt or that first trial, they might have steered clear of it. But a lot of them couldn't resist. They wanted to try something new. So by the time they tried something new, it got to be a habit. And when it became a habit, they were slaves to the habit, and it took them down. This happened to a few young players, unfortunately. But I tried to tell Thad Nevin about things like this because I'd seen it happen. Mm-hmm. And I had managed to steer clear of it myself because I had no desire to go that route. So I guess they listened, at least partially, and it probably helped them. At least I hope it did.
I believe while you were in New York that Art Tatum became something of a mentor to you. How well did you know him? What was your relationship to him?
I had met Art when he was playing in Buffalo. When I was playing at the Anchor Bar across town in Buffalo, there was a place called McVan's, another nightclub. And Art used to play there periodically during the year and a half I spent in Buffalo. And whenever he would come into town to play, after our last set at the Anchor Bar, we'd go over and catch his last set. And I got to hear a lot of Art Tatum in Buffalo. After Art finished playing at McVan's, he would often go to a restaurant down in Midtown or somebody's home. Somebody would invite him to come to his home to play. And he would play until the early hours of the morning. Let's say maybe the late hours, maybe 11 or 12 o'clock the next day. That's how he played. He liked to play like that. This happened almost every time I heard him play there. And he would invariably have a case of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. Maybe I shouldn't mention that. But anyway, he'd have a case of... Too late. He mentioned this. He would always have a bottle of beer in his hand, or not when he was playing, of course, but after he finished playing. But he liked to drink beer at that time.
So what was your relationship with him?
I had met him, and of course I was fascinated. I was enthralled. I couldn't believe it. I look at him and I say, it's impossible to do what he's doing. But I'm sitting there and I'm looking at him and I'm watching him do it, and I still don't believe it. But it was almost magic. It was really magic. The things that he could do on the piano and right up until his demise. He was fantastic. He was undoubtedly the true genius that you hear the name flouted around so much. Art Tatum was a true genius.
Now, I know you met Thelonious Monk. I don't know how close you ever got to him. But when you first heard his playing, did it sound wrong to you? You know, because he was playing dissonances that most people would have thought of as mistakes. And he was playing these kind of like erratic rhythms that didn't fit the predictable rhythm patterns that people were playing. So did you get it right away, or did it sound wrong to you?
Well, it never sounded wrong to me. It sounded different. And even the dissonances that he played, they were intentional, you know. So to me it sounded like, okay, he wanted to prove something musically, and this was the only way to do it. If you played conventional harmony at that point, it wouldn't have had the impact. So he used the dissonance to emphasize what he was doing.
What impact did it have on you to hear him?
Well, it left a very, very... I was in awe of what he was doing because I had never heard anybody who thought musically that in that way. Use intentional dissonances. Oh, some composers have used it, but not to the extent that Monk used it. Monk used it on every composition he played. If he played Body and Soul, or any ballad, you could tell immediately that it was Monk because his stamp was on it. The way he voiced his chords, his choice of chords, his choice of harmonic patterns and so forth. This was distinctively Monk. He was a stylist. He was an individual with a style that was just almost impossible to imitate.
Now, from 1959 to 1976, you worked as a staff pianist for CBS television and radio. The shows that you played for included The Ed Sullivan Show. What else?
Gary Moore show, Jackie Gleason, and two radio shows, and some television shows that didn't make it. And also, there was a television show called American Musical Theater. Well, I conducted that show a couple of times, you know. But they played mostly classical music on that show. But the other shows, the Ed Sullivan Show, the Jackie Gleason Show, and the Gary Moore Show were variety shows. That is, they had comedians, they had dancers, they had singers, they had dog acts, sometimes elephant acts, and so forth. You know.
Oh, yeah, people juggling plates and all of that stuff.
Plates,
all,
so, exactly.
So you had a play for the elephant acts and the people juggling plates and walking the tightrope and for Ella Fitzgerald, probably. And
yeah.
Was that fun?
It was, but it was interesting, you know, because from week to week, you never knew quite what you were going to have to do that particular week. You found out during the rehearsals, but sometimes things happened during the show that didn't happen at the rehearsal. Sometimes you had to improvise something might go wrong during a live show. See, if it happened during a tape show, you can always stop the tape. But if it happened during a live show, you have to improvise as you go along.
You did a lot of session work, too. Did you record on any records that became big hits, but nobody really knows that you were the pianist on the record?
I don't believe so. Not often. I've done some things with Ella Fitzgerald that almost everything she did was a hit,
yeah.
hit record.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
of course, I recorded quite a bit with her. Also, I was lucky enough to work with Marilyn Monroe. Now, ordinarily, she's not to be considered to be a singer, but she did sing very well.
I actually
like
her singing, yeah.
Primarily an actress. I had the occasion of playing for her when she sang Happy Birthday and Thanks for the Memories for President Kennedy.
That was you at the piano?
That's right, yes. And I tell you, she did 16 bars. Eight bars of Happy Birthday to You and eight bars of Thanks for the Memories. So in 16 bars, we rehearsed 8 hours. So I think that's something like a half hour per bar of music, you know. She was very nervous and upset. She wasn't used to that kind of thing. And I guess who wouldn't be nervous singing Happy Birthday to the president?
Right.
And she got through it very well, I think. But it was a very trying experience.
Okay, well, we have this on CD, so let's hear it. Marilyn Monroe with my guest Hank Jones at the piano, singing to the president.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Mr. President. Happy birthday to you.
Marilyn Monroe serenading the president with my guest, Hank Jones, at the piano. Hank Jones, you know, we were talking about how you played at CBS for many years and did a lot of studio work. What was your reaction to John Coltrane's music when your brother, Elvin Jones, was the drummer with Coltrane? And you know, Coltrane had been doing a lot of pretty far-out experimentation, playing very free.
Yes.
Did you relate to that?
Well, to tell you the truth, I didn't relate to it very well. It was an approach that I had heard, but I had sort of rejected, because I had been listening, you have to understand, I had been listening to people like Lester Young, Chu Berry, Coleman Hawkins, Charlie Parker. And this was quite a feel from what John Coltrane was doing. And I understood what he was doing, but I just didn't agree with it musically at the time. Later, I began to accept it, I think, more. And, of course, Elvin, my brother, was with the band, so I had another reason for listening to it more carefully, you know. And it began to make more sense to me as time went on. And I think it took a little bit of time for me to get used to it.
You didn't record a lot with your brothers, but what was it like when you did play with them, with Elvin and Thad Jones? Was there any kind of special connection? I mean, you were older than they were, so I don't know if you played together much as kids.
Well, we didn't play much, very much as kids. Because remember, I left the Pontiac scene and the Michigan scene years before they did, maybe 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been in New York for almost 10 years before Thad and Elvin came. Although, you know, when I first got to New York, I mentioned their names to people like Leonard Feather and some others, and they were included in Leonard Feather's, one of his books. Their names were in his book long before they got to New York, you know. But they were not strangers when they arrived there. And of course, they had already played with some of these people who had come through Detroit and played at the Bluebird. But We didn't play together because we just went out in the same place at the same time. And our musical tastes differed somewhat, but in many ways they were very similar. But it was just a question of being in the same place at the same time. And we just, unfortunately, we're not. We did two things together, two record dates. And, of course, I played down at the Village Vanguard for a time with the Thad Jones and Ralph Lewis band. And I had to cut that short because it didn't coincide with my CBS schedule. I couldn't stay up all night and then work all day at CBS, so I had to give it up. But we didn't play together as often as I would like to have, and that's unfortunate because it's impossible. But
did you feel like there was any kind of special connection when you did play together?
Yes, I did. I thought there was. There was always something special. And that's one of the reasons I regret that we didn't do more of it. I'm truly sorry about that.
The jazz critic Whitney Balliot, who's quite a fan, as you know, of your playing, once wrote, "Jones's solos think." And then you once told Whitney Balliot, "Concentration is the difference between the great players and the players who are not great." Do you think when you're soloing?
Well, yes, you do. You know, but your thoughts are running ahead. Let's see, if you can separate your thoughts from your actions, they're tied together, of course. But your thoughts are ahead of what you actually do. Because by the time you get to the place, your thoughts are maybe four or five bars ahead of where you actually are physically at the piano. So by the time you get there, you've already played what you thought like 4 seconds, 5 seconds before that, you see? In other words, you're thinking ahead. So yes, you're concentrating and you're thinking.
You know, a lot of people might think, oh, it's just intuitive.
I think that plays a part of it, but it's certainly not the main thing. Mm-hmm. You have to know what you're doing. In order to know what you're doing, you have to think about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to, first of all, you have to know the music that you're playing. You have to know the tune that you're playing. You have to know what the chord progressions are. And then, okay, now the improvisations are intuitive. Of course, the intuition is based on prior knowledge, isn't it? I mean, how can you be intuitive if you don't have some prior knowledge of what you're doing? So the prior knowledge always comes into play there. You must have thought of it before that.
As you approach your 87th birthday, does it surprise you that you've, outlived and outlived for years your younger brothers, Elvin and Thad?
Well, I don't know. I tell you, it's certainly disheartening. I don't know. I don't know whether I should feel surprised or not. I've always lived my life a certain way. I don't know. Perhaps my lifestyle had something to do with my longevity. Hopefully it did. But nobody lives forever, of course. And maybe it was just their time. It is not my time yet, you know. I intend to go on until I'm 250. I'm working on that now, actively. I hope to play better than I played the last time. That's my objective, to always do better, to reach another level.
Does that mean you're still practicing? I mean, do you still, practice at
home? Oh, of course. Oh, of course, yes. I don't see anybody can do without practicing, you know.
So what do you do when you practice now?
I do scales, exercises, and I try to learn new material and review old material. You see, I try to be conversant with the piano. You have to be on good speaking terms with the piano, or the piano will rebuff you. I've heard the piano described as a man-eating monster with black and white teeth, and it's true.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us. It's been wonderful to talk with you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Pianist Hank Jones, recorded in 2005. He died yesterday at the age of 91. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.